Some of you, just to get the elephant in the room, some of you are probably wondering why I'm preaching in my Crocs this morning. No, Chris, it's not gout. I'm not telling you. I'll tell you in September. I might wear them all summer, and then in September, I'll tell you why. Did you say no? The first service you've been in like 4 weeks, and now you're correcting me in real time. This is a new gin. All right. Well, I'm going to need just a second. I love grace. Stop. But I can hear the birdies chirping. All right. This is a new series. I'm going to try to do my job now. This is a new series. We're going to, this summer, be going through the life of David. And as we go through the life of David, one of the things that I'm reminded of, and it's why it's important that we return to these stories, is because there is an element to them. Now, they are true, so I don't want to reduce them to fictional stories, but they are still stories, and they are the stories of us. And there is something wonderful about story that ignites within us our imagination. It tethers us to the people who came before us, who told them. And I think there's something wonderfully romantic about revisiting the stories of the Bible and telling them fresh and new and seeing them with real human eyes, because here's the reality of the stories that are in the Bible. These stories that you and I get to read, that pastors preach, and that they talk about in kids' ministry over there where we hear most of the Old Testament stories, they were all told for generation after generation after generation. We get to read them. We get to reference them. We get to say, What happened during the rule of King Saul? And then we can open our Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 7 through 15, and we can see what happened to Saul. We're not encumbered with memory. But for hundreds, if not more than that, of years, these stories were passed down generation to generation, granddad to grandson, grandmother to granddaughter. They were told orally. They were carried forward by an oral tradition. So it is right and good to tell the stories, because they were told generation after generation long before they were written down. And so it's good for us to look at the stories. As we approach this story this morning and the life of David, we really can't just jump into the life of David without a bit of context about where he came from and who he followed. And so this morning is going to be more focused on his predecessor, a guy named Saul, who got to be the first king of Israel, because we really can't understand David until we understand this dynamic that he had with Saul and the stories told after him. And to understand Saul, we need to understand Israel just a little bit. So very quickly, Israel began to form as a nation of people, began to grow in population in a region of Egypt called Giza. This is where Joseph's family migrated down, a descendant from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob had a son named Joseph. Joseph went to Egypt. The rest of his brothers moved down. That's a gross oversimplification, but that's what happened. And then 400 years later, you flip the page of Genesis 50 to Exodus 1. And Exodus 1 is 400 years later. Moses has just been born, and the Israelites exist as slaves in the nation of Egypt, and their numbers are anywhere from 40,000 to 500,000 strong, depending on the research that you do. Most lean towards the larger number, but we don't know for sure. And so they are there. They are a group of people. They are a race of people. they are not in charge of themselves. They have a sort of hierarchy, one would assume, based around their shared faith and religion that they've accepted from their father Abraham, but they don't have a working government or anything like that. They just exist as a people who have slaves, who are slaves. And then one day, God raises up Moses to free them from Egypt and take them into the desert where they wander for 40 years. Until that generation passes away due to sin and lack of faith, and the next generation goes in under the leadership of a great general named Joshua. Joshua crosses the Jordan River, conquers modern-day Israel. God tells him to conquer everything and everybody, but he leaves some remnants behind. And this sounds crazy and like I'm saying it to be controversial. I am not. I'm just saying it because it's true, and I think it's really interesting to see how the biblical stories intertwine with history because they both are history. And one of the great sins of Joshua was that he did not eradicate everybody like he was supposed to. He was supposed to claim that land for God's children and God's people, and he didn't. And he left behind slivers of people, and he left behind the sliver of people called the Philistines. And the Philistines are who David is going to battle against largely several hundred years later in this book, because Joshua wouldn't take care of that. And by the way, do you know the land that the Philistines occupied back when Joshua invaded Israel to take it over? Gaza. That's still happening, okay? So the Bible intertwines with these things in these places, so it's good to understand our history and our stories. I don't have a larger point to make there. I'm just saying it's true. You do with that what you want. So they move into this land, and then we get to the book of Judges in the Old Testament. And in the book of Judges, God wouldn't give them a king. You don't need a king. I am your king. And they said, yeah, but all the other countries have a king. And God says, yeah, but you don't need one. You have me. And from time to time, he would raise up a judge to overthrow. What would happen is the surrounding nations would take advantage of the fact that they didn't have a king, that they weren't a strong nation. Because let's understand what's happening in geopolitical politics right now. Israel is a weak sister of the poor. Israel is the tune-up game that Alabama plays in late August to get ready for the hard teams. Like they get paid to play the big boy teams. They're not good. They're very small. They're very uninfluential. They really don't matter. They have no established government. They have no established economy. Their religion is not known by anyone outside of them. In terms of influence and import, they were almost non-existent on the geopolitical scene. But they're here, this fledgling nation just trying to figure themselves out. And so often, other surrounding nations, when it was advantageous to them, would come in and oppress them, namely like the Midianites or the Ammonites or the Amalekites. All the ites would come in and they would oppress Israel, and they would make they would use their labor and make them slaves again. And so God would raise up a judge, and a judge's role was to be a military and civic leader for a limited amount of time. And those judges, Samson, Deborah, Barak, Gideon, Jephthah, they would be risen up and overthrow whoever was oppressing them. And then once everything was back to peace and good, they would continue to exist, but they would step out of their judge role and refer back to God as our king and the priesthood as the ones who speak to us on behalf of God. And in the midst of this, Samuel, a guy named Samuel, becomes like the foremost prophet in Israel. And it is through Samuel that God most often chooses to speak. And so the people of Israel go to Samuel, and they say, Samuel, we want a king. And Samuel says, you don't need a king. God is our king. I speak for him. I'm not your king. I don't want to be your king. God is the king. He speaks through us, and we speak to you, and that's all that we need. And they go, but every other country around us, this is at the point at which Israel becomes a middle school kid. Everybody else gets one, we want one too, is the basic argument of it. And if you don't give it to us, we're going to turn our breath until our face turns blue. And so eventually, God says, you tell them, if I give them a king, he will tax their crops. He will conscript their sons, and they will die in war. He will make their daughters servants. They will not like the oppression that a king brings. But if they want one so badly, they can have one. And Samuel, in this wonderful, egotistic, uncharacteristically, I would say, egotistical fit, says, God, they have rejected me. And God has to gently correct and be like, they're not rejecting you, buddy. They're rejecting me. Like, you're ancillary to this, Samuel. He says, they're rejecting me, but we're going to give them a king. So then the question becomes, well, who's the first king going to be? And here is the first king of Israel in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 through 2. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherah, the son of Aphiah of Benjamin. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. I was so worked up about the names that I couldn't read the rest of the normal words. This is who they chose. This is who the king's going to be. There's a man of the tribe of Benjamin, tribe of good standing. He was the son of this person. Those names are included so we could get his lineage, but also know that he had the chops. He was from one of the good established families in Israel. He was the most handsome man that anyone could think of at that time. So, just very similar to me. And it says that he was head and shoulders taller than everyone at the time, which, if you take my height now and compare it to the average Israelite then, I don't know, it could be. I could be the prototypical Saul today. I hope I'm not, because it gets pretty bad for Saul, and I'm pretty much preaching a whole sermon about not wanting to be Saul. So that was a stupid joke to make. But he is the most handsome man in the world and that they have known. And he is a head and shoulders taller than everyone else. This is, let's just admit, who we all would pick. If we're trying to pick a leader, that's who we pick. There are studies done that the more attractive and the taller you are, the more assumed it is that you should be given authority. That's like a known thing in sociology. So for myriad reasons, Saul is the obvious choice, and that's who they choose. And he's made king, and everyone celebrates it, and everyone is happy about it. Now, here's where I want us to stop in the narrative for a minute and just reflect on this. Think about this with me. I'm going to make this simple statement. We'll put it up on the screen. You can fill in the blank if that's your thing. But then I want to talk about it for a minute and really think through it. At this point in his life, Saul was positioned for incredible influence. Saul was positioned for incredible influence. Think about this. They don't know what's going to happen to Israel. I saw, just really quickly, I thought this was hilarious. I was talking to Jen about it yesterday. She saw it too. There's some like GIF or JIF or meme or whatever you're supposed to be called. This person, and the video is silent, but they're labeled 2026, and they're talking really emphatically to somebody. Like, they're over the top on this and a lot of this and oh my gosh. And then the other person in the conversation is labeled 2019. And 2019 is going, no, what? No. Like, and it's really funny, because if you could talk to someone in 2019 and be like, hey, let me tell you about COVID. Let me tell you, like, listen to all the stuff that's happened in the last 6-7 years. That's Israel on a much grander scale. They have no concept for what is about to spring forth from this fledgling nation. They're very small, very inconsequential. No influence, no power, no wealth, no respect. They have no idea that this God that they follow, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is the God of the universe. Because, and when I say that, remember, they're surrounded by other nations that have other gods and other ways of believing. And so while they may believe that internally, or while if we want to be really real about it, you know how there are some of you in here right now who believe in Christianity, but in the back of your head somewhere, you're going, but are the other gods gods too? You know that there's plenty of people out there who would say, I'm spiritual, but they don't know how to name the God, even though they live in a quote-unquote Christian nation. So is it completely unreasonable to think that in Israel in this day and time, even though they are brought up to believe that their God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is the God of the universe, do they not notice the other gods around them? And so then wonder, is our God the true God? Now, we know our God is the true God, but what did they know then? They don't yet know because the story hasn't unfolded yet. They don't have the benefit of hindsight that we do. They don't know that the king that comes after Saul is going to receive a messianic promise, a covenant from God called the Davidic covenant. They don't know that, promising that the Messiah will sit on the throne. They don't know that a couple thousand years later, Jesus of Nazareth is going to be born. He's going to be God incarnate. He's going to live a perfect life and die a perfect death. And he's going to rescue everyone. He's going to reconcile everyone back to God. He's going to make a way for everyone to be reconciled with God. They don't know that. They don't know that that same Jesus is going to leave a church behind, is going to ascend into heaven, and then he's going to come back for the living and the dead. They don't know that. They don't know how crucial they are, that they are the linchpin of human history. They don't know that. But God does. And Saul is supposed to be and becomes the first king of all of that. It should be the star of Saul flying over Israel now. It should be the throne of Saul that Jesus comes to sit upon. It should be his nation in his line. He didn't know, but we do. What an incredible opportunity for influence he had. Because of that, it's really important to know the story of Saul and to understand how he used his influence. He's been granted, plucked out of obscurity, sat on this eternal throne, granted incredible opportunity for influence. What does he do with it? Well, we get some glimpses of this in the narrative. One of the first glimpses we get is Saul is going off to battle. He's going off to fight one of the surrounding ites. And Samuel, remember the high priest, the one that still hears from God and talks to the people on behalf of God? He wasn't the high priest, but he was a prophet and he talks to people on behalf of God. Samuel says, go to this place and wait for me. And on this day, I'll come and I'll perform a sacrifice. And after I perform the sacrifice, God will bless the battle. He'll bless the efforts and you can go and you can make war and God will have blessed it and you will win. So Saul says, okay, and he goes and they're there for the requisite amount of days, but Samuel's still not there. And the men kind of start to clamor. This isn't going to work. What are we going to do? Should we just go? Like, Samuel's not here. And Saul says, I got it. I'll step into the place of the sacred mouthpiece of God. I'll take this on myself. I'll perform the sacrifice and then we will go to war and we will win victoriously because I will win for us. I will accrue for us. I will acquire for us the blessing of God. I will step into that place. I will take that role of authority. Isn't this what people in authority do all the time? Because I'm good at one thing, I get to be good at everything. Because I'm in charge in one place, shouldn't I be in charge everywhere? I think what's one of the exercises in life that's really, really fun is to see particularly men who are in charge everywhere they go to Christmas at their wife's house where they don't matter at all. And they can't tell anyone what to do. And people who are used to making all the decisions just have to sit there like this. It's so great. I have to do that sometimes. But this is what Saul does. He steps in and he says, I got this. Well, Samuel shows up and he's committed a great sin. And this is Saul's explanation of himself in chapter 13, verses 11 and 12. What have you done? Asked Samuel. Saul replied, when I saw that the men were scattering and what and that you did not come at the set time, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. Now, on its face, this might seem excusable. Makes sense. The men were starting to scatter. I knew that we had military advantage here, so I needed to act quickly, so I did it. And maybe that's excusable, maybe it's justifiable, maybe it's not. But we know from Scripture that God doesn't see the outside, He sees the inside, that He judges the hearts of men. And based on the fallout from this, there's some version of this motive is true that Paul wanted to accrue more power for, or Saul wanted to accrue more power for himself. It's not enough to have civic authority. It's not enough to have political authority, but now I'm going to claim a piece of this religious authority because I don't like that Samuel gets to tell me what to do all the time. So I'm going to step into those shoes and I'm going to be that too. So Saul, we begin to see, Saul used his influence to gain position and possession. He used his influence to gain position and possession. Here he is with this incredible opportunity. You're the king of the chosen nation of God, the very first king. If you do this right, everyone who follows will come after you and you will be remembered forever. You have incredible opportunity to serve God's people and to serve all people by holding this mantle well. And how does he use the influence that he gets to gain power and possession? To gain position and possession. The first thing he does, his first great sin, is to say, I'm going to claim some religious authority for myself and put myself in that place. The next great sin that he commits is that they're sent to war, and God says, all the plunder from war you take and you devote that to me as a sacrifice. And instead of doing that, Saul kept some things for himself and allowed some of his men to keep some things for themselves. Obeys God a little bit, but not a lot of bit, not all the bit. And so now he's in big trouble. He uses his position, his influence, to gain further position and further possession. In short, when given an incredible opportunity of influence, Saul uses it to benefit himself personally. He turns it on him. And here's what we should acknowledge from this story. Our tendency is to be like Saul. Our tendency, when we are given influence, is to use it for ourselves. Now, maybe we don't use it to gain religious influence. Maybe we don't use it to gain possession. But we begin to use it for ourselves. And there's a couple of things of clarity in a juxtaposition that I think might be helpful here. Obviously, the point of this sermon, one of the points, is to juxtapose the life of Saul with the life of David. In Saul, we have a man that used his opportunity and influence to further himself. In David, we have a man, though excruciatingly human, though terribly flawed. It's one of my favorite parts of the story is that the Bible just unabashedly hangs all of David's dirty laundry out here for us to deal with and then gives us the Psalms where he washes it and he deals with it and he presents it to us. He's bleeding in front of us in these pages. So we do not want to set up David as this moral exemplar at all times who is a perfect human. David was remarkably flawed and remarkably human. And that's why I love his story so much. Because God called David a man after his own heart. Even though there are myriad examples of times when he wasn't. But God doesn't say that about Saul. And I believe one of the biggest differences between those two is that ultimately, Saul used his influence to benefit himself. And David uses influence to benefit others and to point towards God. It's also important to offer at this point in the story as we move through the narrative that sometimes these stories can be difficult to relate to. Though interesting, though compelling, none of us are ever going to be king. None of us, we can, sometimes in our culture, we'll call ourselves those names, but kings and queens of what? None of us are ever going to have the opportunity that Saul had. That ship has sailed. And so when we read about these grand figures in history, I think we kind of disassociate a little bit because we can't relate to that. I'm not going to have those kinds of opportunities. So let's reframe it in a way that makes sense to all of us that we do have. First of all, everybody in this room has influence. Everybody. To varying degrees. And even in your own life, in varying seasons. Those of you who are a little bit longer in the tooth can remember times at which you felt like you had very little influence at all. And then times when you felt like you had great influence. That maybe you even lived a life where in some rooms you were the most influential voice that entered that room almost all the time. And then after that, you're a grandparent. And you have relatively no influence again. Or authority or however it works. So we all have influence, sometimes over a few, sometimes over many, sometimes great, sometimes small. But we all have the ability and the opportunity to impact others. Also, smaller than that, we all, like Saul did, have opportunities. We all, like Saul did, have naturally given gifts. Saul was handsome. He didn't do anything to be handsome. God made him handsome. Saul was tall. He didn't do anything to be tall. God made him tall. And those things got him thrust into a position that he did not earn and opportunities that he did not deserve because God named him that and off he went. So the way that he was just naturally bent, the family in which he grew up, the Benjaminites, all lent themselves to opportunities that he had in his life. And this is something to which we can very much relate. We all come from parents. Hopefully, very good parents. Some of us, not so good parents. But all of our parents, in one way or another, made indelible impacts on our lives. All of us were born with certain gifts and abilities, with certain opportunities that are unique to us, that not everybody gets to experience. I think of a buddy of mine, and I'm going to use his story not only to illustrate this point, but to take us back to the larger point made and where we want to end today. This is a friend of mine that grew up hunting and fishing. He grew up with access to those things. I did not grow up. I grew up, my papa tried to make me grow up hunting and fishing. And if my grandfather is called Papa, you know I had the opportunity, okay? I could have been something. I might right now know how to sight a rifle. The only time in my life, I'll tell you this is how little I know about hunting. The only time in my life I fired a rifle, I was firing it at a tree. And it was my roommate in college's rifle. And I was like, dude, I just want to shoot a rifle. Never done that before. We're out of a national park. There's people, you know, they were at least 50 feet away. No, I'm just messing around. There's nobody around. And I'm like, dude, I just want to sight. I want to sight the rifle. Or I want to shoot it. And he was like, all right, just go around and shoot over there. I was like, okay. So I go on the other side of a car and I'm shooting at this tree that I don't know how far away it was. 30 clicks. Is that a thing? And I know that's not a thing. I'm just making fun of myself. And I sight down on it. And what I did not know, and if any of you have ever have the opportunity to shoot a rifle with a scope on the top of it, do not put your eye against the scope. Don't do that. No one told me that. So that's what I did because I wanted to really nail that tree. And I fired it. And it kicked back directly into my face, the bridge of my nose. Watered my eyes a little bit, got it together, and went back to my buddy Gerlach. I handed him the rifle, and he kind of looks at me. He goes, "How'd it shoot?" I said, "It was great." He goes, "Did you have fun?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Get your nose a little bit?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "Then why is it bleeding?" Darn it. I just had blood running down. I had to clean it off. So I didn't grow up knowing how to do that stuff. But my other buddy did. He grew up knowing how to do that stuff. And then as an adult, he has opportunities to go hunting and fishing and spend the weekends going hunting and fishing. And that's great. And here's the thing. Someone who thinks like Saul would say, "What? I have an opportunity here. I grew up developing a skill set. I have all the equipment that I need. I have the relationships that I need. I can go, I can spend my weekends doing this. This is a wonderful thing to do. I really enjoy it." And somebody who thinks like Saul would think, "How can I benefit from this further?" And typically the way that goes is you get your hunting buddies, you get everybody, you go. If we're being honest, buy a couple cases on the way. Start crushing those when you get to hunting camp. And then you spend the weekend just hanging out with your buddies. And you drive home Sunday, a little bit worse for the wear. Did you get anything? Don't know. Maybe. I think Adam got a doe or something. He was very young. Like, maybe. We don't know. Did you have fun? Yeah, we had a great time. Whereas, and who does that really benefit? I guess you and your buddies. Whereas my other friend, what he's done with that opportunity and that skill set, is he was telling me how a couple weekends ago he had an opportunity to go and hunt and fish. But it's with this ministry that works with veterans who were recently released from the military, and they have spiritual questions, but they don't know where to go. They don't know who to turn to. So they hook up with this organization. And guys that volunteer in that organization take those guys hunting. They take them out to fishing and hunting camp. And they spend the whole weekend with them. And they get to use the same skills and the same abilities and utilize the same opportunities that they had, but now they're using it for something that matters for eternity. Because the guys that come with them are primed for spiritual discussions. They got questions and they don't have answers. And in that setting, these guys are willing to be more inquisitive and open to what is happening and what they could possibly learn. And so my buddy takes his skill set, the opportunities that he was born into. Remember, Saul didn't pick the family he was born into. When I was born, I didn't know I was going to have a papa, but I did. And those opportunities were in front of me. He did, and his opportunities were in front of him. We didn't know we were going to have a certain skill set. You're born tall, you're born handsome, you're born pretty, you're born sweet, you're born smart, you're born athletic. You're born charismatic. You're born caring. You're born empathetic. Whatever it is, you didn't choose that. Those are all represent opportunities that you have that were given to you by God. And here's just this one example of this one person who has opportunities and gifts that were given to him and doesn't use them to just make himself better and have more fun. And how can this benefit me, me, me? No, I have this opportunity. How can I use it to benefit others? And this is the place at which I believe we can relate to Saul, because none of us in this room are ever going to have the opportunity to be the first king of the chosen nation of God, which is a bummer. But we will have, for the rest of our life, myriad opportunities to use the gifts that God has given us to benefit ourselves or to benefit others. Because Saul used those opportunities to benefit himself, God says some of what I believe to be the most crushing words in the Bible in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 10 and 11. "Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, 'I regret that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and not carried out my instructions. Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. That phrase, "I regret making Saul king." Some of us may wonder at that point, how does God regret things? Doesn't he know everything? I would encourage you not to get caught up in that. Sometimes human authors have to put human words on God-sized emotions. And it's our fault we can't understand, not his fault for not explaining. So the sentiment is, God regrets making Saul king. Here's all this opportunity that I chose for this person, and they squandered it on themselves. And it makes me wonder this question. I wonder if God has ever regretted making me anything. I wonder if God has ever regretted making me anything. There have been times. And obviously the implication here isn't for me to preach the rest of the time around you. It's just to you about me. It's just to invite you into my conviction and my question for me, because you ought to be asking the same question. Has God ever regretted making you anything? To that end, there have been times and seasons where I have thought, surely God must regret making me a pastor. Surely God must regret making me a dad or a husband. Surely God must regret giving me these opportunities because I'm really not using them in the right way. Do you wonder if God regrets making you anything? If the use of your opportunities and your influence and your gifts is so egregiously selfish as to only render pain and only in the short term benefit yourself while you really cut off your nose to spite your face, to the degree that God would say, I regret making them blank. It is a sobering statement in the life of Saul. And just to relieve your tension a little bit, David, if he didn't, should have had moments where he thought, God must regret making me king. God must regret making me a husband. God must regret making me a father. But there is a fundamental difference in David and in Saul, that despite of their both being human, when David faltered, it didn't bring God to a place of regret. And I believe that there's a few different reasons for that, and we're going to explore those over the series. But one of the biggest reasons for the context of the sermon this morning, the biggest reason is how David repented. Okay, just spoiler alert for that one. But the reason we're looking at this morning, what differentiated David from Saul, is how he sought to use his influence and his opportunities. I framed it up this way. The last note says, who will we seek to make great with our influence? And this is done with the idea, and I've asked the Lord to leave that up there for a minute. This is done with the idea that Saul was seeking to make himself great, but David sought to make God great. And that's all well and good, but I think even on a more basic level, as I was thinking about it this morning and praying through it this morning, on a more basic level, what helps us even more is to think about it this way. Let's change that the words make great to serve. Let's change those two words to serve. Who will we seek to serve with our influence? So we're not thinking pie in the sky, kind of nebulous, wispy ideas of who am I going to make great, and then so equate ourselves with the grandiose kings of the Old Testament and this greatness to which we all pursue and this unattainable goal where the rest of us can kind of check out because none of us thinks we're great and none of us thinks we're going to be great and none of us thinks anybody's going to remember us after a few years. Like that, we don't aspire to greatness. We are rational people and life has beaten that out of us. But we can serve people, can't we? We can serve others, or we can serve ourselves. And here's what's really important. If we spend our lives serving people in the name of God, if we use every bit of influence and opportunity that we have to benefit others rather than ourselves, I don't know if you will become great, but you will have a great life. I don't know how long you'll be remembered, but it'll be for a while. And I don't know how many people would come to your hypothetical funeral, but I know that if you spend the rest of your days using your influence to benefit yourself, that crowd's going to be small. And I know that if you spend the rest of your days using your influence and opportunities to serve others and build them up, that there are going to be a lot of people who are grateful for you. And with the right mindset and the right mentality, lest we make it about ourselves, those people who are quietly great, who quietly serve, who quietly give, who unassumedly show up. And you look at them and you go, there's a wonderful person of God who has spent their life in service. When you think of that person and you try to give them credit for being impactful in your life, what do? I didn't do anything, it was God. We might never be great, but we can live a great life by choosing to use it to serve others instead of ourselves with whatever influence and opportunity we have. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the stories. Thank you for how rich and good they are. Thank you for the people that are in them. Thank you for exposing their humanity and fallibility in the pages of your holy word. Thank you that we get to see their bright spots and their low points. God, I pray that it would remind us that you see all of our bright spots and all of our low points all the time anyways. I pray that we would see ourselves in these stories and in this text, God, in ways that require courage because they hurt. But also, God, let us see ourselves in these texts so that we might be encouraged and see you redeem people and know that we might also be redeemed. See you speak to people and know that we might also be spoken to. See you use people and know that we might also be used. May it not just be warnings, God, of who not to be, but may we see in these texts and in the story and in these series who we can be if we trust you and we serve you and we love you and we need you. And we are broken by you. In Jesus' name, amen.